I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of our hundreds of past programs over the past 10 years at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Condor of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the Triangle Center for Evolutionary Medicine, or TRISEM, a nonprofit center exploring the intersection of evolutionary science and medicine. TRISEM is jointly operated by Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and North Carolina Central University. TRISEM is an incubator that promotes innovative developments in the theory and practice of evolutionary medicine by fostering cross-disciplinary collaborations among Triangle-based scholars, physicians, public health workers, and more. And last but not least, it is my pleasure to welcome another new underwriter to the Radio In Vivo family. Radio In Vivo is now supported by NC State University's Genetic Engineering and Society, or GES, Center. The GES Center functions at the nexus of natural science, engineering, the social sciences, and humanities. It includes multiple disciplines, stakeholders, and publics in collaborative research, education, and engagement, generating knowledge and fostering balanced and inclusive dialogue regarding emerging genetic engineering technologies and products. The GES Center is working to better understand the technical, ethical, and societal dimensions of genetic engineering in order to address the needs of society. For more information, visit the GES Center website, go.ncsu.edu/GES. Welcome to a special edition of Radio In Vivo. Today on the show, we bring you a very timely panel discussion about the Zika virus, which took place November 27, 2016, at the UNC School of Medicine. The panel was moderated by Dr. Claire Farrell. The discussants were Drs. Elizabeth Stringer, Ann Lyerly, and Helen Lazier. All are UNC faculty members with expertise in Zika. Please enjoy this panel discussion called Unraveling Zika.
The WHO recently rescinded its declaration of Zika as a public health emergency, but as many of us have probably seen in the news, two recent national stories have shined a spotlight back on Zika virus. So last week it was revealed that babies who appear to be born free of microcephaly in Brazil were developing a neurological condition a year old. Another local transmission has been reported in Texas. How does this change what we know about the virus, how we address concerns of women, and how do we address this in North Carolina?
Well, perhaps I'll start. First of all, is the sound okay on this? Okay. So the WHO did recently rescind emergency declaration around Zika virus. And that doesn't mean, though, that Zika virus is done and that it's not important and that it doesn't continue to be an important concern. What it means, though, is that we're entering a new normal where Zika virus is probably going to continue to circulate in many of the areas where it is now, and that we have to learn how to live with this virus. And even though the emergency status being a new virus may be passing, we're now entering into a time when we have to deal with this in an ongoing kind of way. And that's highlighted with this recent report of a local transmission of Zika virus in Texas. So this means a person in Texas who was infected with Zika virus without having traveled to an area where the virus is circulating, they were likely infected by a local mosquito. Much like we've seen these cases of local transmission in southern Florida as well, this is not surprising. We know that the mosquitoes that transmit Zika virus are present in these areas, and that we see occasional infections with viruses like dengue that are transmitted by the same mosquitoes. And so I think this is part of the new normal, where we can expect to see examples of local transmission. And this is something that we're going to have to learn to deal with on an ongoing kind of basis.
And I think as can you hear me? I think as a clinician, we must not become complacent about Zika. And the main reason is because the fetal effects can be so severe and the neonatal effects can be severe and ongoing and devastating. And so we really need to keep doing research to better understand timing of infection and what the sequelae are. And there's so much we don't currently understand about Zika yet, even though we've done some research in the past year, but there's much that we don't know.
Just to add, I think the news that has recently come out, particularly about effects postnatally, highlights the fact that this is a rapidly moving and evolving target. And so what we think we know can change, which highlights the importance of both continuing to study the virus, but also in assessing and reassessing our research agenda and the priorities in our research agenda when we think about, for instance, who the vaccines should be directed at.
So the most vulnerable population that could be infected by the Zika virus are women who are pregnant, who might soon become pregnant, but given our paucity of research studies available in which pregnant women can participate, particularly popularity, why is this such a complicated issue, and how do we try to direct our thinking in the right ways to address the problem?
Well, Dr. Farrell, you asked a question very close to my heart. There has been, for decades, a long-standing reticence to include pregnant women and the interests of pregnant women in the research agenda. Research with pregnant women can be very complicated. It can be scientifically complicated. There are extra layers of regulations, and it can also be morally complicated. But the response, unfortunately, has been that a good portion of the research community has turned away from conducting research with pregnant women and has conducted research in other populations and then used drugs and preventives like vaccines in pregnant women and studied them post-op if they've studied them at all. So this has resulted in a really problematic state of affairs for pregnant women who are facing threats of disease or real or actual disease because there aren't adequate data to inform their decisions about how much medication or preventive to take, or about whether to take it, whether it's safe for the fetus, whether it's safe for them. So that's been the state of affairs with chronic medical conditions across obstetrics. In the context of a public health emergency like Zika, it's particularly problematic and worrying. We don't have much to offer pregnant women, and therefore, there is a very tight link between what our research priorities are and our ability to respond well to pregnant women in crisis. So in our work, we have highlighted that it is not a time for the status quo when it comes to research with pregnant women, that we have to sort of push through our reticence about including pregnant women in research and think about how best to meet their needs.
In addition to a lack of understanding about medications for pregnant women in sort of a clinical setting as well, this is a knowledge gap from a basic science standpoint as well. So prior to working on Zika virus, my research expertise is understanding pathogenesis of mosquito-borne viruses. So I was sort of new to come into the area of congenital infection. And one of the things that was surprising for me to learn when I started to try and understand some of the mechanisms of congenital transmission of Zika virus is how little we know about congenital infections, just generally. So for Zika, it's surprising that the virus would be transmitted from mother to child. That's not characteristic of other viruses in this family. So that was surprising. But even for pathogens that we've known for a long time are transmitted from a mother to her fetus, viruses like rubella or cytomegalovirus and other pathogens like toxoplasma, we understand very little about how these pathogens are transmitted from mother to fetus. And so I think this is something that's been eye-opening to me as well as in my work on Zika virus, is understanding mechanisms by which pathogens are transmitted just generally. This is another area of where we have so much to learn.
I think in light of that, we were having actually a really interesting discussion before the panel. We started early, sorry. you were highlighting some of the issues that you face even trying to develop appropriate protocols for working on Zika virus yourself in the lab as a woman and as a pregnant woman, and how we should approach that, you know, given the sense of urgency surrounding the virus and also the need to have science move forward at a pace that was appropriate. I was wondering if you could share some of your insights from that experience.
Yeah, I think Zika virus before the current outbreak was a very obscure virus. And there had been almost no basic science research published on this virus. And so given the starting point with Zika virus, it's just extraordinary the pace of discovery about this virus over the past year. It's just been astonishing the rate at which we've learned new things about this virus. And one of the reasons that's been possible is because this is a virus that can be studied under fairly routine biocontainment procedures. You don't usually have to use a lot of special precautions for studying this virus, which is very different from some emerging viruses like Ebola virus or SARS coronavirus, MERS coronavirus, where you have to use much greater safety precautions working with these viruses. And so because a larger number of labs have the equipment and the procedures that you need to study Zika virus, this has really opened up research on this virus to labs in neuroscience, in development, and in other areas of science. And so that's been great. But it means that we have to think too about whether those procedures are adequate and how can we protect pregnant women in particular who may be more vulnerable to the adverse effects of being exposed to the virus.
And you know, from each of your perspectives, what do you feel is the biggest unknown about the virus, given how quickly research has proceeded and given how I think sometimes from a 10,000 foot view how diffuse our focus has been at times, sort of like leaping from one hotspot to the next or one new discovery to the next.
I think for me, as a practicing doctor, some of the biggest questions remain about timing of infection. Is there a time in your pregnancy, if you are exposed to Zika, that has worse consequences on the fetus? And what are the long-term outcomes from babies who are infected with Zika? We are learning new things every week, but we still lack long-term prospective studies on infants who are infected with Zika. I think we're all going to have different things that we think are the most burning questions to learn about Zika.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really raises a lot of questions, though, for how to talk to patients and how to think about prioritizing different kinds of research when we don't understand what perinatal infection means for moms and babies. We're still discovering that, so it raises lots of challenges for thinking about how to talk to women who have been infected, how to frame precautions, and how to think about, for instance, risk-benefit trade-offs in the context of clinical trials.
One of the things that's surprising about Zika virus is that it's able to spread by roots and cause disease that are unlike other viruses that it's related to. And I think we really don't understand why that is and what it is about Zika virus that lets it cause these different kinds of disease. So that's congenital infection, sexual transmission, that really are not characteristic of other viruses that are similar to Zika. So that's an area that we're very interested in understanding.
So given all of these questions, I do always wonder about forgotten focuses or things that are being neglected as our focus shifts. Are there things that you feel have gotten left behind, populations of people or scientific issues that you feel are getting forgotten in the way our discoveries are progressing?
Well, I mean, I think, interestingly enough, when people started talking about the R&D agenda, so developing vaccines and pressing them through the pipeline, even though pregnant women were at the crux of concern, questions about how best to include them and their interests in the research agenda were really pushed to the side. One journalist said, well, research with pregnant women is a practical and ethical nightmare, so, we're just not going to deal with that now. We need an effective vaccine. Even early on, when the WHO started developing their guidance for for the populations to whom the vaccines should be directed, they identified women of childbearing age as the target population for vaccines for obvious reasons and generally good reasons, which were that if you can vaccinate people before they get pregnant, that's the best thing, right? You don't want to get Zika at any time during your pregnancy, and we thought that in the early days, we thought that the real harm was confined to first trimester infection, and so vaccinating somebody in the second or third trimester might miss the boat. So there was a sense of relief in the beginning that, well, this is not a case where we have to think about pregnant women or their interests or this tangle of ethics and regulations and cultural taboos against conducting research with pregnant women, because we're going to vaccinate people before they get pregnant. But the fact of the matter is, if you think about that in that very narrow way, then you are abandoning, basically, the very wide array of pregnant women who are not going to get the vaccine before they're pregnant. So there are going to be people who fall pregnant before the vaccines are available, and then vaccines might be available. There are people that are going to fall pregnant on vaccine trials, and they are going to want information about what they should do given the fact that they've been exposed to vaccines. And there are going to be women who want access to the trials themselves, who are pregnant and have nothing else, no other kinds of preventive measures to turn to. And so, surprisingly to me, oh, I'm not supposed to do that, but despite the fact that we were talking about these profound, heart-wrenching genital abnormalities, there was a way in which, and there still is to some degree a way in which, pregnant women have been pressed aside. So we have seen this before in other epidemics, in other situations, and that's actually where I see Zika being both, something tragic that we have to deal with, but also an opportunity for looking hard at the way that we think about pregnant women, the way we think about risk, the way we think about advancing science. And this may just be the moment that we need to sail into a storm that we should have sailed into a long time ago.
I think in addition to issues of excluding pregnant women in these studies, there's issues about women more generally bearing the burden of this epidemic. And you can see that in recommendations that women should just avoid becoming pregnant for 2 years, which in addition to having a variety of practical obstacles, it again places the burden on women to not become pregnant as though they were the sole actors in this process. And this becomes even more problematic when you also think about things like, oh, women should just protect themselves from this, exposure. Well, that's a fine thing to say if you live in, the northern United States and you stay inside all the time. But for the women who are really affected by this outbreak, that's just not a practical opportunity for them. It's just not something that's possible to do. And then with every new thing we learn about Zika virus, it seems to add to the burden on women to shoulder from this epidemic. And so there's evidence that this virus can be sexually transmitted. Well, again, that turns into an obligation on women to protect themselves from this exposure. So I think there's so many different angles and ways in which this has been an epidemic that's really hit women the hardest. And in a way that I think there are so many other infectious diseases where women bear a disproportionate burden, but that's not something that we're really used to seeing in the area of vector-borne diseases and in mosquito-borne viruses. So it's been a new way to have to think about these problems.
And I think it's really important, especially when we talk about vaccines, to bring women and pregnant women to the table to discuss what they think. How should the studies be conducted? And creating registries and just bringing their information public. So,
could you all discuss the known modes of transmission of this virus and some of the issues that they raise in the science?
There's sexual transmission, there's mother to child transmission, there's the rare case of one lab exposure. Are there other
what we continue to think is the main way this virus is transmitted.
And carrier transmission as well, just presumed to be needle sick or?
There's been one example where someone seems to have been infected by close contact that was not sexual. I think it remains unclear what exactly happened there. That's probably an exceptional case, where there was a patient with an extraordinarily high amount of virus in their system, and it seems to have been passed on to a caregiver, likely through some mode of close contact with the bodily fluid.
How are you counseling your patients, and I'm sure more than your patients, are you counseling other countless people who accost you at Thanksgiving dinner and everywhere else? If I've been asked questions, you've probably been asked 10 times as many.
So I primarily see pregnant women, and it certainly is on their mind. There's been so many news stories about Zika, and pregnant women ask me, should I be worried about living in North Carolina? Am I going to contract Zika in North Carolina? And I reassure them, no, but it is on everyone's mind. And we are recommending that pregnant women or people who are considering pregnancy not travel to endemic areas. And right now, that's Latin America, Central America, if possible. For example, we have a nurse in our clinic who's pregnant, and she wanted to go to Miami for her baby shower. And I told her that I recommended she not attend the baby shower in Miami because we just don't know. And we think that the sequelae are worse in the first trimester, but there are reports of maternal fetal transmission in the third trimester with fetuses having sequelae. And so I think we don't know exactly enough to tell patients with confidence, yes, you can travel to endemic areas. We're starting to see more patients here at UNC who have exposures, and most of these are recent immigrants, and we are mostly providing reassurance to them and getting ultrasounds. And I think that testing can be reassuring if the testing is negative and if the ultrasound is negative. And so there's a great benefit to doing that. And people are like, well, what are you going to do if it's positive? Well, most people are going to be negative. And so I think there's great benefit in both ways.
And sorry, when you talk about testing, you're talking about testing.
Testing for Zika. Now, and that's a whole other.
Testing blood?
Yes, testing blood. Now, diagnostics are very difficult for Zika. And so right now, we have two ways of diagnosing Zika for more recent infections. But in the public sector, we don't have a test for a past exposure to Zika. And that also, it may confer some benefit if you've been exposed to Zika in the past and you had a recent Zika infection, but we can't really test for a past Zika infection yet in the public.
So there's some challenges for doing Zika testing right now. And in terms of what we're currently capable of doing, if someone has a very recent infection, we can detect that. We have tests that are actually pretty good at detecting past Zika infection in people who haven't previously been infected with related viruses. And so that's going to be the case for most people in, say, North Carolina. And really, the challenge is in being able to diagnose Zika infection in people who've previously been infected by related viruses, particularly dengue. And this is a challenge for people who live in Latin America, where most people have previously been infected with dengue virus. But I think it's worth noting that this is fundamentally a technical challenge. There's a lot of different research groups working to develop better Zika diagnostics, and there's every reason to think that we're going to be able to develop more specific tests that can accurately diagnose Zika infection, even in people with prior dengue immunity. Those tests aren't ready yet, but that's fundamentally a technical problem that's likely to be solved. That's not very reassuring to your patients right now, but hopefully it'll start to become available before too much longer.
And what would be the most useful application of such a test in your mind? Would it be somebody who had traveled to an area and wanted to know, you know, if they had been exposed before they became pregnant, someone who was already pregnant, everybody?
So I think the value there would be if you have someone who's pregnant and wants to know, you know, they return from their trip and they would like to know if they've been infected with Zika virus, and they'd like to be able to provide reassurance. That's a scenario where if the test comes back negative and we don't think you've been infected, then you're in good shape. The challenge is if it comes back positive, there's so much we don't know that it's hard to provide information about what that means or what the outcomes would be, because we just don't know. Another way a test like that could be useful would be for, let's say, women who are considering becoming pregnant. As far as we know, a prior Zika virus infection from the past, there's no reason to think that that's going to impact a future pregnancy down the road. And so that might be another way to provide reassurance that if you already have immunity to Zika virus because you were infected before, that likely would mean that you wouldn't become reinfected during your pregnancy. Much in the same way that now, as part of early prenatal care, we'll be testing, say, someone's rubella virus titers to check that they have immunity to rubella virus and couldn't become infected while they were pregnant.
And that becomes important because we don't give rubella vaccine in pregnancy for someone who has not seen rubella before, but then we can vaccinate them after they deliver. So if there were ever a Zika vaccine, if someone were negative, we could vaccinate them in the postnatal period.
And it might depend on the kind of vaccine as well. I think probably one reason not to get a rubella vaccine is that it's a live virus vaccine. There's a variety of different types of Zika vaccine under development, and some of them may turn out to be appropriate to give pregnant women. I think that remains to be seen.
I mean, as a reminder, I mean, there are a couple of vaccines that we currently recommend in pregnancy, including Tdap and influenza, which are both a kind of vaccine that there's pretty widespread comfort with, and one of the vaccines kind of at the head of the pipeline happens to be a kilt vaccine. But it's also worth noting that while we worry a lot about administering live vaccines in pregnancy, in most cases we don't do it unless there is a threat usually to the life of the mother, like as in the case of yellow fever. Sometimes pregnant women get yellow fever vaccine, which is a live vaccine. They're really, the risks of even the live virus vaccines are primarily theoretical risk. We can imagine that there could be a risk to the fetus from using those vaccines, but we haven't, for instance, documented a case of congenital rubella syndrome as a result of vaccination. So it also sort of is a moment for us to examine our aversion to the use of certain kinds of vaccines and how we think about theoretical risk in the context of pregnancy and a threat to either the mom or the baby.
I think theoretical risk takes on a whole new level of intensity during pregnancy, right? And that risks that would have been perfectly acceptable to you prior to that point, all of a sudden the balance shifts. And it's hard, especially with something like Zika virus, where there are so many unknowns. And even when you have good information, making those choices becomes difficult during pregnancy, especially now in a scenario where we don't even have good information and it's hard to get reliable advice in a lot of ways.
Besides the ways that we can protect women that we've discussed, we've talked about vaccines, we've talked about women avoiding mosquitoes, we've talked about women avoiding sex, are there any other ways that we're thinking about protecting, especially pregnant women, from the effects of Zika? Specifically, we've used immunoglobulins to certain viruses in special cases in pregnancy. Is that something that's being considered for exposures?
I don't know of any for Zika that are being considered. Do you know, Dr. Walter?
There are antibodies in development that have been demonstrated in animal models to be able to confer protection in an animal system. And so the idea would be that that could be something that you could potentially give a pregnant woman. Now, that's not an approach that's going to be at all useful for the vast majority of women who would be experiencing a Zika virus epidemic, but there could be some cases where that would be useful. Ultimately, you're looking for a vaccine.
And in your mind, what would be the ideal vaccine?
Well, that's somewhat of a challenge, because the ideal vaccine would be one that is safe, right? But the vaccines that we are comfortable with, these killed virus vaccines, we think about them as being safe, but the ones that we also would want a vaccine that has durability, so it maintains your immunity to the virus over a long period of time, and those vaccines tend to be the live virus vaccines, which we're less comfortable with. So how do you put those two things together, right?
And with the rapidity with which Zika has crossed the epidemic in Brazil and the Yap Islands, so many people will be immune now, right? And so how does a vaccine play into that population when we know if the epidemic is, moves through a country, there may not be a need for a vaccine. But right now, as it is exploding, we need a vaccine, right? And there will always be people who are not immune and still need a vaccine.
I I think that gets into this idea of the new normal of endemic Zika, mm-hmm. right? So we've passed the emergency and the emergent state, and so now what's the reality of living in a world where you have this mosquito-borne virus that's going to continue to circulate and has the potential to cause birth effects? How do you deal with that? And I think it's going to be true that the number of infections will decline as the population develops immunity. I wouldn't expect to see forever the same intensity of infection that we see right now. But there's other reason to think that the virus would continue to circulate if we use related viruses as examples, particularly dengue virus. That's a virus that continues to circulate throughout the same areas, transmitted by the same mosquito. And importantly, even in areas where there's a high level of dengue virus circulation, you get adults who are becoming infected. And that's a good indication that you can't count on everyone developing natural immunity during childhood. And that's why I think it would be really important to have a Zika vaccine that you can give in childhood as part of a childhood vaccination schedule to ensure that women have immunity and that they have population level immunity to protect women during their childbearing years.
So I know this panel is all about women and we're focusing on women and Zika, but Dr. Lazier, in your former lab at Washington University in St. Louis, you highlighted some findings that Zika can cause male infertility in mice. What do we know about the potential of male infertility as a result of this virus at this point in time?
Yeah, so there have been a couple of recent reports using mouse models. One is from a lab that I used to be a member of, and this was work that happened after I left the lab. I wasn't directly involved. And also recently from another group as well, showing that in mice, when the mice were infected with Zika virus, that it caused damage to the male reproductive tract and also impaired fertility in the mice. I think we don't yet know if that has any bearing at all on infection in human men, but it's reason to think that this is something that's worth studying. We know that Zika virus can be detected in semen, and that we can detect the virus for an extended period of time, even after the initial disease appears to have resolved. So I think we don't know the effects of Zika virus infection on men and male fertility, and that's something that's important to study going forward. That represents yet another area where the more we learn about Zika virus, the more surprises there are, and the avenues of important research that need to happen just keep growing.
And I think there's current research going on in Nicaragua, and Dr. Sylvia Becker-Drebs is working on that with shedding with in vaginal secretions and semen and breast milk. And so with grants from UNC, they are studying, you know, how long shedding can occur and transmission.
So what kinds of concerns does this raise for returning travelers or for people who are worried about exposing kids or babies or partners? So how are you advising your patients and how are you keeping this from a scientific perspective?
So CDC does have recommendations, and it's not really based on good data that we have for women who are returning from an endemic area who are considering pregnancy. They recommend waiting 8 weeks. For men, they are recommending 6 months, and I think that's based on findings of Zika in semen up to 180 days, you know, after someone acquired an infection. Again, it's not really based on the data, and so Helen and I were discussing prior to this, if someone is viremic at the time of conception, that could potentially cause a problem. But if you are not viremic prior to conceiving, it's probably a really low risk, but it's going to be a problem, although we don't know. And so right now, I'm advising my patients what CDC is recommending, and currently it's 8 weeks for women and 6 months for men, and those could change as we gain more information.
I think this is yet again getting to this idea of that weighing those risks and benefits becomes even harder when you're talking about pregnancy and something that can cause birth defects, right? And the idea of an abundance of caution becomes this huge weight that you have to take every possible precaution because the potential effects are potentially very severe, but we don't have the data to base this on, and I think there's ongoing studies that will help supply that data soon, but that's not very helpful to people who are trying to get pregnant now. And you can imagine there's many couples where 6 months is a long time to delay pregnancy. And these are important decisions that people have to make about their families, and it's hard given the lack of good data to base these decisions on. And there's tremendous efforts underway. I think we're going to have better data very soon, but it's a challenge for families dealing with these questions right now.
And I think it's a challenge for clinicians too, because 6 months does seem like a really long time, although we don't have good data. And so we want to err on the side of being super cautious because of just microcephaly and congenital Zika syndrome has such long-term consequences that we want to try to avoid that at all costs. And that does come at a cost, right?
Yeah, there is a cost, right? So you can consider if you're dealing with, for example, maybe an older couple who are looking at a scenario where their odds of conceiving are diminishing. To say at least 6 months, that could be a long time. Or perhaps a couple where one member is in the military and is going to deploy, right? That might be a scenario where maybe you don't have 6 months, right? And so those are risks and benefits to weigh. That's a challenge without good information to base that on.
And currently we're not running Zika viral loads on semen. So maybe tests will evolve where you can change recommendations, I think, and be more patient specific.
Right. Right now it's not recommended to say test semen for Zika to provide more information for counseling. And I think that's because we just don't know how sensitive that is and how long the risk is and the false positive rate on the test, that sort of thing. And again, with more data, and hopefully we'll be able to have more information to guide those decisions, and maybe there could be a way to test that to give couples better advice about risk for them specifically.
I mean, it's also, I think we, in an ideal world, we plan when we're going to have our children, but surprises happen about 50% of the time. So when we're thinking about advice, it's in the context of pregnancy and reproduction, and we're not always exactly in control of that.
I think that's such a good point. It's easy to say, oh, well, just don't get pregnant for 6 months, or just delay pregnancy, and that really isn't a reality, whereas about 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, and that's even here in the U.S. where we have a fair amount of resources, and is making them less so in many other areas bearing the brunt of this epidemic, and that simply planning to wait isn't always an option.
So you guys have done a great job of discussing this so far. I mean, I think it's clear that the guidance we're able to provide people about timely conception, the guidance we're able to provide people about avoiding Zika infection, about protecting a fetus, all is fairly flawed based on very scarce data and oftentimes scattered data. How good do you think our advice for the general public is? Specifically, you highlighted a really interesting point that I hadn't really thought about, which is the granularity of our geographic restrictions in the United States versus blanket restrictions on an entire country in the case of Mexico.
And I guess first of all, I should say, I think that everyone's providing the best information they can.
Certainly.
I think the one reason that the recommendations change a lot is because we are getting new information rapidly and trying to update those recommendations as best we can to provide people the best recommendations. But there is a lack of data, and so something we were talking about earlier is that you can go on the CDC website and they'll give you information about what are the areas that have local Zika transmission. Because if the recommendation to pregnant women is don't travel to areas with local Zika transmission, you have to know where those areas are. And so you can go to the website and it'll list all these countries that have local Zika transmission. And in general, that's just listed on an entire country basis. And so this is something that happened earlier in the epidemic after the virus was introduced to Brazil, it's been made its way northward. As soon as there was one case in Mexico, in southern Mexico, the entire country gets colored on the map, right? And that's very problematic for a lot of areas in the country where there isn't any Zika virus. Right? So it's a big country, and that's problematic for, say, tourist areas where there's not actually any Zika virus transmission, but now pregnant women don't want to travel there. And that's in contrast to the information that we have about, say, local transmission in Miami, where you have this very granular detail about where the virus is circulating, and there's a four-block area marked off on the map about where exactly in Miami this virus is circulating. And so I think that goes to show, even from the same source of information, that there's a real range in how much information we're giving to inform people's decisions about what to do.
And in an ideal world, what kind of information do you think it would be best to provide?
I think more granular data is better, because we know that Mexico has many provinces. And as you said, this came up at my annual meeting. There were Mexican researchers there, and they thought we were just painting, with broad strokes, a Zika epidemic in their country, and it was isolated to certain provinces. And so I think, especially for travel restrictions, more granular data is better. And I think it also helps curb some of the hysteria.
Mm-hmm. We certainly provide the level of information with something like malaria. And we get, CDC website provides very detailed information about, the risk according to your elevation and so forth. So it does seem like it would have an adverse impact on the entire country. And what about the advice that we're giving women in terms of timing conception? Do you think that people have adequate information both here and abroad, or do you think we can give people better guidance? Just recently, there have been questions raised even about late presenting Zika, and similarly, actually, I just got a question today saying I traveled to Belize, which seems really low risk, but and I am not planning to become pregnant anytime soon, but shouldn't I still be working? So I feel like there, the range of tiny surrounding conception that we worry about is expanding and expanding.
I think the real risk is periconception going forward. And that's right around the time you become pregnant going forward. And so I think that is the information we should be promoting. It's interesting, we're in our clinics here at UNC, we're asking patients if they traveled, and patients are asking us about the risk of Zika, but we're seeing more and more people who've been exposed, let's say in Puerto Rico, and now are seeking their prenatal care here. And it seems to me that the information that they're getting is not as intense as the information we're giving our own patients. And that we are really, promoting this idea of testing and ultrasounds, which I think is good in one sense, but it seems like it's on the other spectrum, for example, in some of the countries where we're seeing patients coming from. And one of the things that Sylvia and I were talking about in some of the work we're doing in Nicaragua is that the pregnant women, that there doesn't seem to be a big focus on sexual transmission. And we are going to be conducting a study among pregnant women, and this, I think, is also an ethical issue that maybe Annie can speak to, is that we want to promote WHO guidelines that say you should protect yourselves and practice safe sex in an endemic area. However, if the Ministry of Health is not promoting that same message, how do you promote an ethical health message that may not be promoted in this by the same Ministry of Health? You know what I mean? So what we're going to do is provide pamphlets, that are factual on how to avoid, contracting Zika and what the WHO is recommending, because that seems like the ethical thing to do.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit more why the Ministry of Health is diverged from?
Well, I think that, and I don't have evidence for this, but I think that this becomes a thorny issue with this epidemic because the question is, well, what do you do with information, right? How are we going to change the course of this pregnancy, or we don't have, you know, we don't want to create mass hysteria in our countries. I think that there is benefit to knowing if someone, if a fetus has been infected in utero, and we just with other developmental delays, if infants are given more intense therapy, they can do better than if they're not. So I think there's definitely benefit in diagnosing infants early. And so there are things that we can do, but there may be a sense of, well, what are we going to do about it? You know, it's just so overwhelming. How are we going to message this appropriately?
Well, one obvious option for women in terms of deciding what to do if they discover that they've had a Zika-exposed pregnancy is whether or not they would want to seek an abortion. And that's an issue that sort of looms over a lot of the discussion about how to deal with Zika. And it's important, I think, to consider that across the area where the Zika virus epidemic has been most intense, that the legal status of abortion varies widely across that region. And that has important impacts for women in these areas, both in terms of the legal status of abortion and practical access to it, which are not the same thing, in terms of what options are there for women for what do you do with this information.
And it raises the other question, which has to do with if you give somebody information, but it's incomplete information, so sort of impose, if you will, a deep uncertainty about the right course of action, it raises all kinds of moral issues, right? So if you have a Zika-exposed pregnancy, that doesn't mean you're going to have an affected baby, right? And oftentimes, we know even more so that we won't learn about the effects of Zika until later on. So how do you make decisions about a pregnancy when you have a certain amount of information that it doesn't tell you what's going to happen and it doesn't tell you what the right thing to do is? So, you know, information always has, I mean, we always think, especially here in the U.S., that information is better, but the way you provide it, the way you frame it, and the options you give in the context of it really has an effect on whether that the provision of that information is an unquestionable good, right?
We don't know how many fetuses are going to be infected in moms who have an infection in pregnancy. And it's probably, if we base our experience on other viruses, the majority of fetuses are not going to be infected with Zika. We just don't have that information yet, and that's something we really need to learn. And then of the babies who are infected, what proportion are going to be affected? And that's another thing that we really don't know.
And affected can mean a lot of things. It can mean very debilitating neurodevelopmental defects, or perhaps milder effects as well. We really just don't have a sense of what is the spectrum of possible outcomes. What is the probability that those occur in an infected fetus? And what's the probability that the fetus is infected in an infected mother?
So it does seem like there's no time in the whole sort of pregnancy timeline from sort of, you know, thinking about conceiving all the way to the postpartum period where a woman would be out of the woods, so to speak, if she were to become infected with Zika.
I think that's the general consensus, is that you probably are not out of the woods until you gain more information.
I think that's probably true. I think the evidence that we have is probably that the most severe outcomes result from infection earlier in pregnancy, but that as we're learning more about the spectrum of possible outcomes, and we broaden the number of things that are included in congenital Zika syndrome, that we're starting to recognize more outcomes that can happen from infection later in pregnancy as well.
And the Zika virus seems to being particularly neurotropic or attacking fetal brain tissue and developing brain tissue for whatever reason. And so that's another area of study, because we don't know why this virus has that affinity, where we may not see that with CMV. I mean, we do see eye issues and some brain issues, but not, it seems like, with Zika.
I think that's true. There's a lot that we're still learning, obviously, about this virus, but it does seem to be quite neurotropic, especially in a developing fetus. Not so much in an adult. If you look at the viruses that Zika is related to, it includes viruses like West Nile virus, like Japanese encephalitis virus, that do infect the brain in an adult. But that doesn't seem to happen so much with Zika infection in adults, as far as we know. But in the developing fetus, it does seem to be very neurotropic. And even manifestations like improper joint development or other developmental defects actually fall under a neurological mechanism for why they develop.
Potential increased incidence of Guillain-Barré has been highlighted and made much of at various points throughout the past year. I was wondering if you could comment on that. And also, are there any other effects to women's health that we know of following the infection with Zika virus?
There are speculations that it is associated with Guillain-Barré. In Nicaragua, where we're working, there have not been really reports of that. And for women's health going forward, like Dr. Lazier was saying, we think that if you have an infection with Zika, that does confer a risk in the future to getting a bad Zika infection. We don't know that because we haven't followed women long enough for that. There was a recent, or relatively recent case report that I found really interesting where the mom had an incident Zika infection and her fetus was infected with Zika. And the mom continued to have Zika in her blood, or Zika viremia, for longer than the 1 week period where we suspect it normally happens. She had it for about 2 months, and it was thought that maybe she was being seeded, the virus, from the fetus into her own blood. She terminated the pregnancy, and she had an abortion, and 2 weeks after she terminated the pregnancy, there was no more virus in her blood that could be detected.
There's starting to be more evidence of prolonged viremia or virus in the blood in pregnant women. There's other examples as well, and also evidence from animal studies, where in studies with pregnant monkeys, they also have sustained viremia.
I mean, stepping away from the sort of more basic science issues, we know that parents of children who have disabilities can be affected by that. As well, obviously, their lives are changed, sometimes for the better and sometimes not. Sometimes their health is affected, and I also think a really important area of study is trying to understand the lives of women and men who are raising children with microcephaly, particularly in the context of this epidemic that has gained so much attention, around which there is so much fear. So I think thinking about the long-term effects on families is something we have to really understand better and how to mitigate those.
And I think we need to also understand disclosure of results, like culturally appropriate ways of counseling women on Zika results and microcephaly, and then looking at the long-term family effects. And I think that's an area that we know nothing about.
Well, thank you all. Our panelists, if you could please join me in thanking them.
We hope you've enjoyed and learned from this Zika panel discussion. Join us again next time for Radio in Vivo.